twist my arm, so I came. Newspaper editors are famous for twisting arms of reporters. Okay, let me begin with Robert's comments. Let me say, I'm not disappointed. I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued because of two reasons. One, Robert says two things which contradict one another. It's either this or that. He concluded his comments by telling us that he's disappointed because I shifted focus. My focus is not mainly on material realities, material interests, oil, but I moved on to fashionable questions like citizenship and identity. That's how we ended. But he began his comments by telling us that the most important question is, who is an African? That's the question of citizenship and identity. Right? And I'm not surprised he couldn't answer the question. So there's a second reason also I'm intrigued. Robert says the following. He says, look, give them benefit of doubt. They've just started. Now, when I hear that, I'm no longer hearing a discussant. I'm hearing a government representative. Give us the benefit of doubt. Don't rush. Criticize us only when criticism will have no effect. Wait. In other words, it's not Robert. I want to make this clear. It's interesting because it's the relationship between power and intellectuals. The response of power is always, you don't have the problems we are faced with. Okay? Give us time. And there's an element of truth in it. But intellectuals, simply because we are not faced with those day-to-day problems, we are then able to see ahead as to what kind of problem will be created by a complete preoccupation with the day-to-day. So, there's room for both. But the intellectual has to critique. Otherwise, there's no role for us in society. So let me go to the identity issue. I'll take South Africa as an example. You know, colonial powers, they had a new way of administering, a new way of administering the people, because they began by classifying them. The way we classify soils, the way we classify animals, trees. They classified them. They classified them into races, into tribes. For each race, a different administration. For each tribe, a different customary law. In South Africa, they classified them, whites, Indians, coloreds, Africans. In time, there arose movements, African National Congress, Colored People's Congress, Indian National Congress, and the whites had their own. I think it was called Democrats. And the South African regime was happy because the political organizations were as divided, or were divided along the same lines in which the power, the ruling power, had divided them in the census and in the educational system and in the jobs in the civil service, in everything. Then came a visionary leader called Steve Biko. Biko said, "Black is not a color. Black is an experience. Everybody who is oppressed in South Africa is black." The black consciousness movement swept through the different racial divisions of South Africa. It even influenced the ANC, in spite of the fact that they were fighting on different sides, meaning they were seeing one another as competitors. It influenced the ANC. The ANC rethought its notion of African. It left the old notion of African to the Pan-Africanist Congress, African as a race. And the ANC, in the Freedom Charter, 1955, which it had forgotten, it now picked up with the UDF in the 1980s and said, an African is anyone who makes his future in Africa. That's an African. Thabo Mbeki, when he gave his famous speech, "I am an African," in Parliament, that's what it was about. Who is a South African? If the immigrants are not South Africans, if South Africans are only those who can prove themselves to have biologically descended from those who were originally in South Africa, then no more than 2% of the population of South Africa will be South Africans. Because everybody else came from outside at different points. The Khoisan would be the South Africans. The point is not where you come from. The point is whether you turn where you come from into a demand for political privilege. The problem with whites was not that they came from elsewhere, but they demanded a monopoly of power. Once they had given up the monopoly of power, that demand, they could become citizens of South Africa. Many people ask questions. Nationalism. When the nationalists were not in power, they rejected the classification by colonial powers for administrative purposes. They rejected it. We are Ugandans. There were no Bafuruchi. There were no Abafuruchi. We are Ugandans. But when the nationalists came to power, they rediscovered the techniques of colonial powers. They rediscovered that, oh no, tribe is not just cultural. We are going to turn tribe into an administrative fact. For each tribe, there must be an administration. For each tribe, there must be a separate district. So we'll get the votes from there, and we'll divide up the population. So only we can say we stand for the whole of Uganda. Nobody else can say that. And that's the legitimation of our power. If the SPLA in South Sudan, it doesn't matter how many tribes there are. I don't know actually. 20, 200, doesn't matter. But if it turns each tribe into an administrative district, that's the end of the project of South Sudan. That is the end. That's what I've been saying. There's a second thing about citizenship which I would like to point out to my discussant. Because I don't agree that oil is the main issue. Oil actually is not the main issue in South Sudan. You see, it so happens that the facts of the case make it that oil can actually bring the North and the South together. The oil is mainly in the South. But the infrastructure to transport the oil is in the north. SPLM is talking of building an infrastructure through Mombasa. But the latest study on it, the Norwegian study, pointed out it's going to take a minimum of 10 years to build that infrastructure. For those 10 years, you have no choice but to export this oil through the north. You have no choice but to come together and cooperate. And second thing the Norwegian study pointed out is that there is no guarantee this oil will last beyond 10 years. Right? Now, look, this is not an absolute statement, because when you say this water cannot last beyond 6 months, what it means is this, right? The cost of producing this water is 500 shillings. The selling price is 700. But if actually there's more and more water produced elsewhere and the cost follows below 500, it's no longer economical to produce this water. There may be a lot of oil in South Sudan, but the question is, for how long can it be produced economically at today's market prices? So it's a provisional judgment. The issue is not oil, it's citizenship, and I'll tell you why. Start the story with Garan. And I believe what many people are saying, which is that actually if you had a referendum in South Sudan, even when Garang was talking of New Sudan, probably the majority would have called for independence for the South. So the question is this, how come Garang stayed in the leadership? And how come he kept on calling for New Sudan? And I'll tell you the answer. The answer is that Garang's line was successful. A struggle confined to South Sudan was doomed. Garang knew that. Garang knew that for the struggle to be successful, it had to be able to cross the boundary. It would have to isolate the regime in the north. And it is the demand for a new Sudan that allowed Garang and SPLA to cross the boundary into Blue Nile, into southern Kordofan, into the Nuba Mountains, into Darfur. All these movements were inspired by SPLA. But if SPLA had said an independent South Sudan, none of those movements would have come into being. When SPLA demanded an independent South in the referendum, the people most disappointed were its allies in the North. They felt betrayed. The governor of Nuba Mountains, who was number three in the SPLA hierarchy, campaigned against independence. These are border states. These are border states. They, historically, the people in these border states have come from the south in recent periods. They are ethnically southern, geographically northern. What is their future? What is their future? Abyei. Yes, some people may be interested in the oil, but for the people who live there, the real question is that Abyei has been a place where peasants and pastoralists, the Miseria of southern Darfur, and the Dinka, the Ngok Dinka of Abyei, have cooperated over 1,000 years. So that during the dry season, the Miseria comes out. These people go north during the shorter dry season. But now, on two sides of the border, we'll have two different citizens. One of the biggest questions that the Tabong Banking Commission was confronted with, and I know this because I was an advisor to the commission, and I remember writing a paper for them, saying, the big question is citizenship. There must be dual citizenship for certain people, for the border peoples, for the peoples, pastoralists who migrate in and out, and for the southern Sudanese who moved to the north. How many? We don't know. Upwards of 100,000, as many. But their fate is likely to be that of the Eritreans in Ethiopia. They will be the first casualties of a conflict between these two. So political questions are important. by themselves. Because that is how, if you want to ask yourself, if you think that the real question is resources, and if you want to extend it to say the only question is resources, then you will never understand how a minority keeps a majority at bay and is able to control resources over time. Because they can't do it by bribing people. You can't bribe the majority. Because to bribe the majority, you have given up the resources. You do it by forms of administration, which prevents that majority from realizing it's a majority and coming together as a majority. I hope New Vision gives some space in the paper for this point of view. Thank you.
I'll make sure that the best that I can do is make sure the paper is published verbatim and let the readers judge. But that will be done. They are also reporters here, so I hope they understand what you said. The contradiction, Professor, that you spoke about, this runs the risk of being a back and forth between me and you, but the contradiction was shaped by your own paper, because you started with the question of identity, so I had to answer it as well. Otherwise, I would have preferred a different approach. And then just this question you raise about the intellectuals and the people involved in the practical, and why I'm asking for understanding. I'm glad you used the analogy of marriage and divorce. If you look at the priests of the Catholic Church, they have a very clearly defined view about marriage, very well articulated. They have absolutely no idea what it means to be in a marriage. And yet, they tell us what marriage should be and define it for us. We know the practical realities of that, and we ask for better understanding. So that's why we go back to confess every Friday. So it's the kind of relationship that we will have. But I would just respond to one question which was raised about, I think somebody raised the question, what happens to revolutionary leaders? I think that the famous statement, I don't even know who raised it, who said it? He said, I think it says, cometh the hour, cometh the man. Some of these leaders are essentially shaped for the circumstances that they emerged, and after that, they have no more relevance. And in a sense, I actually, personally, my view is that John Garang probably died at the right time. And I think he had served his purpose and finished, and that he would have become, I don't know if he would have transformed himself. Prof, we can have another time to debate the failure, not just by revolutionary leaders, but by liberation movements to transform themselves into managers of the state. It's bigger than just the individual leaders. If you look at what has happened to most of the liberation movements, it's a bit of an embarrassment. And, well, you have a very limited view of the liberation movement in Africa because it consists. The NRM is at the tail end of the liberation movement. You look at MPLA, look at Frelimo, look at what happened to all of them. But I think that the realities that these leaders find in running and managing a modern state are completely different from the idealism that they espouse when they are fighting a cause, because they don't have as much responsibility and accommodating all these dynamic forces that you find when you eventually have to run a state. For instance, I encourage some of you to read the American history, and you can see what happened to all those fellows when they started running the state. Some of them had been fighting with George Washington, and then they get there and realize that the running the state is different. So I think it's the challenges that somebody who has been charismatic, inspirational, I think one of the greatest tragedies, by the way, but also which is the greatest lesson in revolutionary leaders, is Samora Machel. If you read, if you follow his history, you will see what happened. This guy led the most successful liberation struggle and then failed to run the state and then came to the realization that he needed to go back and deal with the imperialists he had been railing about. So it's the complexity of coming down from the idealistic position which makes you charismatic and inspires a following to the day-to-day dealings of ordinary life where you have to make very, very difficult compromises. That's the way that I see it.